Part 1, Outbreak.
Benjamin Maldonado, former chief investigator, Hayden Syndrome, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
The first thing we have to do is admit we blew it. We misidentified Hayden's at the outset, and when we did that, we gave it an extra couple of weeks to spread. And that's what killed us.
Natasha Lawrence, investigator, Hayden Syndrome, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
When Hayden's was first moving around in the world, we were also tracking a new and aggressive variant of H5N1 influenza, bird flu. The bird flu had come out of South China, where it probably got its start in one of the poultry factories there. It had already killed a couple dozen people in South China, and we were seeing it pop up elsewhere, including London and New York, which were the first major population centers we saw Hayden's in. Hayden's first blush symptoms were very much like the bird flu, and a number of the people who contracted Hayden's also had the H5N1 virus in them as well. You apply Occam's razor to the problem of a person having flu-like symptoms who also has the bird flu virus in their bloodstream, and it's going to tell you that the first is the cause of the seconds. And in 99.9% of the cases, that would be exactly right. In this case, it was exactly wrong.
Irving Bennett, professor of journalism, Columbia University.
I was a science reporter at the New York Times when Hayden's hit. I and every other science writer at the time was told it was bird flu and were asked to remind people that this was one of those years where the government had actually gotten ahead of the virus and had adequate stocks of vaccine out there, so people should go out and get their shots, which was fine, until I started hearing from doctors that the ERs were beginning to fill up with people who had the flu who also had gotten their shots. My first assumption was that there was something wrong with the vaccine, that either it was ineffective because of poor manufacture or graft, or that it was the vaccine itself that was giving people the flu. Either would have been a great story. I tracked some of the vaccine that looked like it was failed back to the manufacturer, Synvaxis in Maryland, who agreed to test the remainder of the lot. Those tests came back negative, which is to say, the vaccine was perfectly effective. By this time, other vaccine makers were also testing their lots and finding nothing wrong there either. This is when we knew for sure something else was going on. And then Super Bowl Sunday happened.
Monique Davis, MD.
I was working the ER at Lutheran Medical Center on Super Bowl Sunday. I had traded for that day because I don't actually care about football, and I could bank some favors by taking the day. I figured it would be reasonably light because the Jets were in the Super Bowl, which meant that lots of the people who would otherwise be doing the stupid things that get you sent to the emergency room would be at home in front of the TV instead. I was partly right. The day was light on gunshots and broken bones and violent trauma, but when I started my shift, the ER was already full of flu victims, mostly older people or people who didn't care they might miss the game. When I talked to them, a lot of them said they already had their flu shot for the year. When I sent in the blood work, I told the lab to be looking for something other than the bird flu we knew was going around. By the time the game started, the ER was packed. I texted a friend of mine over at Maimonides, and he said he was getting the same thing in their ER. All over the city, ERs were piling up with flu victims. Some of them were saying they tried waiting until after the game was done before they headed over, but they just couldn't wait anymore. This suggested to me that when the game was done, we were going to get slammed. I told the chief resident that if I were him, I would get some more staff into the ER as soon as possible. We didn't even have until the end of the game. The Jets were down 35 points by halftime, and by the third quarter, there was hardly any room to move in the ER.
Benjamin Maldonado.
New York got the worst of it on Super Bowl Sunday, but we saw a sharp rise in flu-related ER visits in nearly every major U.S. city that day. That told us that whatever we were looking at probably got into the U.S. through New York and then dispersed through air travel, which meant that it was easily communicable but possibly not immediately evident. People who are ill enough to need an ER aren't going to get on a plane. It was something that probably had a considerable incubation period.
Irving Bennett.
Once we figured out that it wasn't the bird flu, but was another sort of flu entirely, I started looking at where it was popping up, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere. Outside of New York, the largest pocket of Super Bowl flu was London. I dug into it more, and as a couple of days went on, I stumbled onto an interesting bit of data, which was outside major population centers, the places that had the highest initial rate of infection for Super Bowl flu were towns with research universities in them. A little more digging, and I discovered that on the third weekend in January, the International Epidemiological Conference held its winter meeting in London, and that the attendees to the winter meeting mapped really well with which university towns had the highest rates of infection. The irony of a meeting of epidemiologists being ground zero for a highly virulent new form of flu was not lost on me, or anyone else for that matter, once the news got out.
Thomas Stevenson, former director, National Security Agency.
When it became clear to us that the IEC winter meeting had been the likely ground zero for what we'd eventually call Hayden's syndrome, we naturally began to research, within the confines of the law and always with the highest possible standard of transparency, the attendees of the winter meeting, including their recent research. We wanted to find out who might have been working on research in line with what we were seeing with the new virus. We were naturally concerned that the virus might not have occurred naturally, and that it had been designed as a potential weapon. Was there ever a determination? Neither we nor any other U.S. government agency were able to officially determine the initial source of the Hayden's virus, nor were we able to determine whether the virus was naturally occurring or had been genetically designed. What about unofficially? Quite obviously, I can't comment on any unofficial findings.
Irving Bennett.
I know of two rumors that are given the most credence in the world of Hayden's historians. The first is that after the First Lady came down with the disease that would eventually be named for her, a factory outside of Mirrenshaw was air-bombed into rubble. Officially, the factory made cold medicines. I suppose you can guess what the unofficial suspicion was. The Times stringers in the area confirmed the place had been turned to rubble, but neither the Pakistani nor the U.S. government confirmed an airstrike. The official cause for the factory going up was intertribal conflicts. Presumably, one tribal chieftain ordered a truck filled with explosives to drive up to a loading dock and then detonate. There was a Pashtun epidemiologist at the IEC, although he was never charged with anything. A second rumor involves a Swiss biology graduate student who had a bad breakup with his lover, a grad student in epidemiology, and also access to viral material and a gene synthesizer. Whether this dumb bastard intended for his new bug to get out into the general population is up for debate. This is a rumor because there's no hard evidence that the presumed creator of the virus did the deed, and we can't ask him because shortly after the first fatalities associated with the virus started cropping up, he took a rifle and shot the back of his head out with it. His former lover, incidentally, was fine, never even got sick. Both of these rumors are reasonably plausible, but for practical purposes, they both can't be true. So, which of these two rumors you find more compelling is a personality test, in a way.
Natasha Lawrence.
It was clear this wasn't the H5N1 variant, so we started breaking it down to see what we had. What we had was a virus that had a widely variable but long incubation period. That's the time between when you get the virus and when you start showing symptoms. But a short latency period, meaning the time between when you catch the virus and can start spreading it to other people. Long incubation plus short latency means there's a fairly large window for subclinical infection, people infecting each other before they feel sick themselves. So that's what happened here. The Hayden's virus is transmissible by air, which makes it easy to catch. By the time the International Epidemiological Conference winter meeting had adjourned, roughly 80% of the 1,000 or so attendees had been infected. They had been in close contact and breathing in each other's air the entire 3 days. And then, when they dispersed, they traveled back to several hundred points of origin on six separate continents, traveling in airplanes packed with other people. From a virus's point of view, you couldn't have asked for a more optimal transmission pattern. Now, that's optimal for the virus. It's not optimal for us. When it came to the Hayden's virus, by the time we knew what we were dealing with, we also knew that it had potentially already spread to millions and possibly billions of people. What we didn't know was how serious this new virus would be. We had half of New York throwing up in ER rooms, but we didn't know how long it would take for the virus to resolve itself and for the body's own systems to beat it. We did know we didn't have a vaccine. The Hayden's virus initially presented like an influenza virus, but when we started looking at it, we realized we really were looking at something new. So the sort of antivirals we use for flu, the neuraminidase and M2 inhibitors, weren't necessarily going to have the same effect on Hayden's. So no matter what, we were in for a rough time.
Monique Davis.
The first phase of Hayden's looked like flu and acted like flu, but it was the worst flu we'd seen. Lots of vomiting, lots of respiratory congestion, fevers as people's immune responses kicked into overdrive trying to kill the virus from the inside. We treated what we could treat, but after Super Bowl Sunday, we knew we were up against something different. People started to die. Old people, people with weakened immune systems, then infants, which was heartbreaking. Those were the most vulnerable populations with any influenza infection, however, so no matter how heartbreaking, it was still understandable and to some extent expected. But then, otherwise healthy people started dying as the Hayden's virus just overwhelmed their systems. One kid came into the ER complaining that being sick was messing with his training for the Mohawk Marathon in Albany, which was going to be run a couple of weeks later. He was dead by morning. That was the frustrating thing about Hayden's. Outside the usual at-risk groups for opportunistic viral infections, there wasn't any rhyme or reason to who got sick, who got better, and who didn't. It was like flipping a coin. Heads, you were sick for a day or two, and then you were fine. Tails, you were laid up in the hospital for a week, or you were dead. About a week into it, everyone stopped calling it the Super Bowl flu and started calling it the Great Flu, because it was something that just wasn't stopping. It was like the Spanish flu in the early 20th century, except so much faster and so much more.
Benjamin Maldonado.
The parallel with the flu pandemic of 1918 to 1920 was obvious, but it's also inadequate. The Spanish flu took 2 years to circle the globe because transportation was slow, and the outbreak happened at a time when the global population was under 2 billion. There were more than 7 billion people on the planet when Hayden's hit, in an era when you can get from one side of the planet to the other in less than a day. The spread of Hayden's was exponentially faster, and affected an exponentially larger number of people. We did have better understanding of disease and a more coordinated global response working for us, but unfortunately, given the specific nature of how the Hayden's virus transmitted, those came into play only after the virus had already spread itself across the planet.
Irving Bennett.
We were having a newsroom meeting about how to deal with the coverage, and my then-editor Brenda Strong said, "It's like a coordinated attack. It's like this virus has blitzkrieged every single place people live." And that's exactly what it was like. We were getting the same news reports that everyone else was seeing, and it was astounding. It was literally everywhere. The only place it seemed not to be was the science stations of Antarctica. New Zealand actually stopped flights down to the South Pole to keep it from getting there. The Hayden's virus went from not even existing to becoming the major global health crisis of the 21st century in under 2 weeks. Nothing like that sort of epidemic spread had ever happened before in the history of the world. It was like viruses declared war on humans and were planning to wipe us out before we could even mount a counteroffensive.
Thomas Stevenson.
Before we learned of the International Epidemiologist Conference's winter meeting, We very seriously considered whether this was in fact an attack on the United States by a hostile party, either a nation-state or a terrorist group. The problem was none of our chatter had indicated that something like this was in the offing. And this is, to be blunt, one of the things we had tuned ourselves to be looking for. It seemed unlikely to us that something of this scale could have been planned without our hearing of it. The enemies of the United States have a tendency to try to pump themselves up before an attempted attack. We didn't pick up any gloating transmissions before Haydens got onto our radar. Even if Haydens had been designed to attack the U.S., it was a very poor instrument for the task. We were hard hit by Haydens' first wave, but we and most other Western and industrialized countries immediately coordinated our responses and locked down further immediate spread of the disease. It was the places without the ability to effect a coordinated response where the disease really took a bite, both immediately and with the later stages. This is why, on a personal note, I think biological warfare ultimately never caught on. Attempting to use a biological agent against your enemy while avoiding its effects on you is like trying to use a grenade by holding onto it and hoping all the shrapnel flies in the direction of the person you want to kill. You have to be stupid or suicidal to use biological weapons. Whoever invented Haydens, if it was invented, was probably both.
Benjamin Maldonado.
2 weeks after Super Bowl Sunday, we had 1 billion people infected worldwide, including 50 million in the United States, roughly 1 in 7 people in both cases. By the end of 4 weeks, it was 2 billion and 80 million. By the end of the year, 2.75 billion worldwide, 95 million in the U.S., 1 in 3 people across the planet got sick. 400 million died. 1 in every 18, just about.
Natasha Lawrence.
The irony today, if you want to call it that, is that people have almost forgotten just how genuinely terrifying that first stage of Haydens was. Almost 4 million people died in the U.S. alone, mostly in those first couple of months. That's like wiping out the entire city of Los Angeles. In an average year, only about 2.5 million people die in the U.S. total. We were barely equipped to deal with all the deaths, simply from the point of infrastructure. Outside the U.S. and industrialized nations, the death toll was even higher as a percentage, and their ability to deal with the dead much lower. And that caused a huge number of problems in terms of secondary waves of disease, infection, and general political and social instability. As bad as it got for us, much of the planet had it much, much worse. There are places on the globe that still haven't entirely recovered, either in population or in terms of social structures.
Irving Bennett.
Here is an interesting fact that I learned from one of the anniversary stories coming up. It was only last year that the global population passed what it was when Haydens first struck. They used to think we'd be at something over 8.5 billion people by now. We're 1.25 billion people short. That's not just because Haydens killed 400 million people. It's that many of those 400 million were of childbearing age. That in the aftermath of the disease, particularly in the developing world, a whole bunch more who would have been parents died in the messes that came after. There aren't that many things that have ever put that much of a divot into humanity's growth curve. The only other thing I can think of that most people know about is the Black Death. That's pretty impressive company, if impressive is the right word to use here. And even the Black Death usually only attacked each of its victims once.
Monique Davis.
After the first several days of the Super Bowl flu, we started getting some of the same patients back into the ER, only this time suffering from symptoms that resembled meningitis. After the first few, those of us on staff started looking at each other like, "You have got to be kidding me." There was no way it could be coincidence that the same people who had been coming in for the flu were coming back with meningitis-like symptoms. The patients were different races, sexes, economic classes. The only thing they had in common was that they had the Super Bowl flu first. We started checking around at the other ERs to see if they had the same thing happening, and they did. Patients were coming back with what looked like meningitis. A lot fewer of them than in the first round, maybe 1 in 4 or 5. But it was definitely a second stage of some sort. Now, it's possible for meningitis to be diagnosed as a flu. They share some initial symptoms. But for the same virus to exhibit flu-like symptoms, recede in most patients, and then return like meningitis in a select few? That was new. And really sort of frightening.
Benjamin Maldonado.
One of the things that researchers don't want to admit, because it sounds more than a little bit sociopathic, is how interesting the Hayden's virus was, and what things we were hypothesizing in order to explain how it was doing what it was doing. With the meningitis-like symptoms, we were confronted with the idea that a virus would attack a body, have the body's immune response beat it back to greater or lesser extent, and then, as a result, wholly reconfigure the way it was attacking the body, but only a small number of the infected. Some of the early hypotheses included reactions to blood type or specific antibodies, a signal dependent on total viral load, or a response to specific environmental inputs like temperature or air quality, or even wireless signal. The last of those is an example of how just because it's a hypothesis doesn't mean it's good or useful. The point was that we were looking for some reason for the virus to apparently mutate, and that led us to be occasionally wildly imaginative in our speculation. It was the most intriguing puzzle that most of us had worked with, and we're talking about a room full of people whose job it is to work on genetic material and other natural puzzles every day. It was fun, or as fun as anything could be, up to the point when you remembered people were out there dying from the thing, and you were supposed to be putting a stop to that. Our problem was that none of our hypotheses fit the data. There was no obvious single environmental or physical factor we could find that would precipitate the change we saw in the virus, at least not in the short term. This was a problem because everyone wanted to know what they could do to counteract or at least avoid the second phase of the virus attack, and we had nothing to tell them. The only way you'd know whether or not you'd get the second phase of the attack was the headache, the stiff neck, and the other symptoms. You got it, or you didn't. This was widely considered an unhelpful response from the CDC researchers, and I don't disagree with that. We were some of the smartest scientists, geneticists, and virologists in the world. We were working as hard as we could on the problem. And it seemed like the problem was working equally hard to elude us.
Natasha Lawrence.
The meningitis phase affected substantially fewer people than the flu phase, but the mortality rate was substantially higher. About a quarter of the deaths associated with Hayden's came from people who died in the second phase. That's because the phase didn't just present meningitis-like symptoms. The virus invaded deep into the brain and started altering brain structure in significant ways. It was literally making the brain rewire its own connections. That was another thing we didn't know a virus could really do. In the lab, we would talk about this virus like it was an evil genius, like it was a Bond villain. It was a joke and a way to have a little bit of levity in an otherwise depressing race against time. But in some ways, it wasn't a joke at all. I think the general thought around the CDC was that this virus was actually the closest thing to malicious that a virus could get.
Monique Davis.
You could see how the second phase of the virus was working in our patients, the ones that were conscious anyway. It would be like a series of little strokes, a little aphasia here, some loss of hearing or sight there, someone having a bit of Bell's palsy over on the next bed. Sometimes the patient would snap back immediately, the brain rewiring itself on the fly, I guess, and sometimes they'd just get worse. Some of them didn't progress, they just died. I had one patient stop talking to me mid-sentence. It took me a minute to realize she had passed. I honestly thought she had paused to collect her thoughts. With the meningitis phase, a lot of what we were doing, to be entirely upfront about it, was keeping the patients as comfortable as we could while we waited out whatever the virus was doing to their brain. A lot of people we couldn't help, and their bodies just sort of let go. Most survived, and most of them seemed to recover all right, with lesser or greater short-term cognitive shortfalls that were eventually addressed with therapies similar to what stroke victims get after an incident. Some experienced permanent brain damage, again, to a greater or lesser extent. There was no way to tell how bad it was going to be until it was over. And then there were the people who experienced lock-in.